May it please the court, James Hardy, attorney number 38173 for the appellant Omar Cruz-Avila. I'll focus on issue one in the briefs and intend to reserve approximately 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case involved a single transaction on a single day, and the prosecution utilized a complicity theory of liability under which it argued both charges identically. The prosecution did not argue that some evidence satisfied the elements of the substantive offense and other evidence satisfied the elements of conspiracy, as we often see. Rather, the prosecution argued that all the facts supported both crimes here. Now, why does this matter? Under Robles' rule, the jury can't disbelieve the same fund of evidence for the substantive offense and believe it for conspiracy. Now, this fund of evidence concept has been described in various ways, defined in various ways throughout the years since the Robles' rule was established in 1966. We've got Armijo from 1969 that talks about the evidence utilized to prove the substantive offense. We have the statute, which talks about the evidence establishing the commission of the substantive offense. We have Bath from this court in 1994 that talks about the evidence relied upon to prove the substantive offense. We have Harrison and Scarce from this court in 87 and 2003, respectively, which talk about evidence demonstrating the participation in the substantive offense. And then Hoffman from the Supreme Court in 82 talks about the evidence offered to prove the substantive offense.
Hardy, I'd like to ask you about the Robles case. After the Frye case, is there anything left of Robles other than the statute that's still in existence?
The statute in the case law interpreted it, absolutely. What the Frye case says in 1995 is distinguishes Robles in this particular situation where we have conspiracy convictions with acquittals on a substantive offense from all the other case law on inconsistent verdicts when we talk about different factors involved there. So what that case in Frye is saying says Robles should be construed based on the statute, and naturally, like every other statute, the case law that interprets that statute. But what it's really saying is saying we don't apply the ordinary principles of inconsistent verdict law here. In terms of the fund of evidence, as I was talking about before, it's important in this case because the prosecution went forward on a complicity theory of liability. The prosecution presented a complicity theory and argued both crimes without distinguishing the elements of either crime. And I would urge the court in making its decision to review the prosecution's closing argument that can be found in the transcript of May 28, 2009 in the afternoon, pages 24 through 32 and 44 through 49.
Mr. Hardy, I'm troubled by the lack of convergence of your argument and the people's argument. And you're saying, well, the prosecution didn't argue that there was any difference between the substantive offense and the conspiracy of offense. And yet the people say, well, there was other separate evidence, even if there was no separate argument, there was separate evidence that could support a conspiracy conviction. What is your response to that contention by the people?
The people's argument, in my view, is entirely dependent on the concept that Mr. Cruz-Avila could only be convicted as a principal in this case. The people's argument is essentially that the jury could have disbelieved that Mr. Cruz-Avila did the actual exchanging of the drugs for the money in this case, and for that reason, everything else that happened before and after that is separate and independent. That doesn't work with a complicity theory of liability and the way the prosecution argued the case here. If you go back to the closing argument that I was just referring to, you'll see that the prosecution runs through the facts of this case, of this single day and this single transaction, argues them indiscriminately, does not argue that any single fact satisfies an element of conspiracy or an element of the substantive offense. The prosecution says, this is why you should find Mr. Cruz-Avila guilty of both offenses at the end of that argument.
But does the prosecution need to say, this evidence is lined up and only goes to distribution, actual distribution? This evidence is lined up and goes to the conspiracy. I mean, are they required to jump those kinds of hoops?
Not necessarily required, but this case is the exact opposite of what you just described, Judge Ramon. In this case, they didn't make any distinguishing mark, and quite clearly actually offered and presented the evidence that the Attorney General is claiming is now separate and independent as evidence of the substantive offense. Again, if you examine that closing argument, you'll see that the four things that the Attorney General points out in their brief that claiming they're separate and independent are the exact same pieces of evidence that the prosecution claimed were evidence of the distribution offense here under their complicity theory of liability.
No matter how the case argued, as long as the evidence exists, independent evidence exists.
I think it absolutely matters how the case was argued, Judge Boris. If you look at People v. Scarce, which I believe is the most recent the most recent grappling with this rule, the Robles rule from this court, 2003, the way that case was decided was based on the fact that a complicity theory was not argued, was not presented to the jury. The facts of that case, there was a segment of evidence. There was things that happened before this aggravated robbery offense. There were things that happened afterwards. The court said that, yes, we find these things that happened before and after were separate and independent, and therefore we can uphold the conspiracy conviction in this case. But the reason we can do that is because the defendant testified and said, I didn't do this actual taking, this actual aggravated robbery part, and, more importantly, that the jury was not instructed in complicity in that case. Had the jury been instructed in complicity in that case, we're talking about a different fund of evidence. The prosecution clearly ran on the principal theory of liability in that case. And the idea that complicity is different, it goes back to Armijo in 1969, which notes that had the jury been instructed on complicity in that case, that we may not have been able to affirm this conspiracy conviction. And that just all goes to the concept of segmenting out the evidence. And I think a comparison to some of the previous cases that have grappled with this rule is apt. I already mentioned Scarce from 2003, which I think is the most recent. But if you look at People v. Hood from 1994, also from this court, you'll see a situation that is 180 degrees from the one we're looking at here. There was a complicity instruction. The prosecution did present complicity. And the defendant ends up in a similar situation with a conspiracy conviction and an acquittal on a substantive offense. The substantive offense in that case was a murder charge. The defendant in that case conspired with the person who's going to be the principal in the crime, who's going to do the murder. At the last moment, the principal chickens out. She doesn't go through with the murder. But then, a month down the road, she actually does do the murder. The court looked at that and said, well, yeah, we can reconcile these because here we have this conspiracy that got frustrated, and the jury could have believed this evidence of the conspiracy. But even though we have a complicity theory, a month later, the jury could have believed as well that he had no part in the actual completion of the offense. I haven't seen a published case where you have a conspiracy conviction, where you have a complicity theory argued below for a single day, a single transaction, that's affirmed a conspiracy conviction under such circumstances. Now, there is a case from 1982, Hoffman, Supreme Court, where you had a whole series of months worth of evidence, and the charge was an attempt to manufacture drugs. And there was evidence that the defendant had been gathering precursors to these drugs for months in advance. And in fact, in that case, unlike this case, the co-conspirator testified against the defendant in that case. The Supreme Court said, and by the way, the defendant in that case also argued lack of intent, which is also similar to this case. The Supreme Court said, even though we have these months of evidence, and we have this testimony by the co-conspirators, given the crime he's charged with, these verdicts are irreconcilable. You don't define it down to simply the last act or the simple single act that you can define as the exchange or the distribution in this case. The fund of evidence is dependent on how the case was presented below.
Well, I thought there was another rule that we had to look at, and that is that every presumption should be given to a jury verdict in this context, if it's at all consistent with the prosecution's theories of the case.
I agree, and I recognize that rule, and I submit to this court that there is no consistency between the conspiracy conviction and the prosecution's theory of the case in this case.
For instance, here we have, as I understand it, a separate and distinct evidence, if you will, that the father-in-law of the defendant had said that he would be coming later in the day, that he would be bringing a guy with him. That time sequence ended up being the time sequence where the defendant was off of work. He did come with him, and the defense theory was that The defendant's theory was that he was going to the store, but in fact they went to the hotel where the direct exchange was made, and they circled the hotel. So why isn't that before they came in and parked next to the confidential informant? So why isn't that separate and distinct evidence that would support a conspiracy jury verdict?
I'd like to address your question, Judge Ramon, and then reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. I disagree that it is separate and distinct. And one of the primary reason that this court can look to see why it wasn't separate and distinct is that every piece of evidence that you just detailed, Judge Ramon, was what the prosecution argued in closing argument. The prosecution argued that the confidential informant statement about this cousin from the mountains was evidence of the substantive offense under its complicity theory. The same thing with the concept that the co-defendant was waiting to the end of the day for the defendant, for Mr. Cruzavilla, to get back from work in order to arrange the transaction. The same thing with the claim that there's an inference from the evidence that Mr. Cruzavilla overheard conversations with the confidential informant as they were driving to the parking lot. And finally, the circling of the parking lot. If you look at that closing argument, every single piece of evidence that we're talking about here was cited by the prosecution in its theory of complicity theory of liability for the substantive offense, which is why we have the identical fund of evidence in this case. And in fact, I would submit that this is a textbook case for Robles. I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt, attorney number 13803. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. The defendant claims that the verdict convicting the defendant of conspiracy and acquitting him of the crime of distribution are inconsistent because of the Robles rule. And as already previously described here, the Robles rule argues or states that a conviction of conspiracy and an acquittal on the crime that is the object of the conspiracy cannot stand unless there's a separate fund of evidence that supports the conspiracy. Now, I do not agree, the people do not agree with the defendant's argument that there needs to be a reason why, the evidence shows a reason why there's an acquittal on the substantive crime, because the statute is the only thing that survives Frye. The Hood case and the Sears case are both cases where there was also another analysis done as to why they convicted on conspiracy and acquitted, mostly because of co-conspirator testimony. But both of those cases are prior to Frye. And post-Frye, only the statute matters. The statute says there has to be a separate fund of evidence, and that's what we have here. Typically, in your most typical place, the evidence of a conspiracy would take place before the substantive crime. And this case is no exception, because all of the separate fund of evidence supporting conspiracy all took place before the crime itself took place. And here are some of the facts that would give rise to the conspiracy verdict. Machis was on the phone all day long on the day of the sale trying to set up the sale, but he was not able to definitively set it up until the defendant arrived home, which gave rise to the inference that the defendant had the drugs. The defendant has the drugs and Machias has set up the sale, and the two of them together go to the scene where the drugs are to be exchanged for money. The defendant is the driver of the car. The defendant gets to the hotel where the deal is supposed to occur, and he circles the parking lot. And the inference is he's either checking for the police or he's looking for the CI, Davidson, who is the guy that he sets the exchange up with. When the two of them locate Davidson, the defendant pulls his car into the parking space next to him so that Machias' passenger side is facing Davidson. This is more than ample evidence of a conspiracy between the defendant and Machias to sell drugs.
Could you respond to Mr. Hart?
I don't agree with that. I think that the jury is free to, as long as you're not As long as you're not taking this evidence, as long as you're not rejecting, let me try this another way. As long as you don't take the evidence of the crime itself and infer the conspiracy from that, you're okay. And I don't think that the instruction on complicity has anything to do with it, except that what it means is that they shouldn't have acquitted the defendant of the substantive crime, which only indicates that it may be leniency on behalf of the jury, but we don't need to know why.
Well, Ms. Pratt, in contrast to what you're saying, isn't the presence of a conspiracy theory given to the jury significant, because it would indicate that any actions that the defendant took in conjunction with Mr. Macias would be probative of a conspiracy or of complicity theory?
Well, I think there you're inferring the complicity from the conspiracy, and I think Robles is the other way around, that you can't infer the conspiracy from the substantive crime, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'm not trying to infer anything. I'm just asking you whether any evidence that the defendant acted together with Mr. Macias would help support his conviction under a complicity theory.
Not necessarily, if he's not actually committing the crime of distribution. Maybe I can clarify it by talking about what the facts are underlying the substantive crime, because they're separate and distinct, and on a complicity theory or not on a complicity theory, they show that the defendant committed the crime. Davidson, who was the CI who set up the deal, approached the passenger window of the car, and the defendant immediately asked him for the money. The defendant takes the cocaine out of his pocket, because he's the one with the drugs, and he hands it to Macias, who hands it to Davidson, and then Davidson hands the money back. If we inferred the conspiracy from that set of facts, that would violate Robles. But since we have a separate fund, distinct and apart from the distribution crime, then we're fine. We haven't violated Robles at all.
What about Mr. Hardy's argument that the people argued the same evidence in support of both the distribution offense and the conspiracy offense? Is that, number one, is that statement by Mr. Hardy accurate?
I don't agree. I think they argued one continuous set of facts, because, as I said, you can draw the line and say, okay, conspiracy ended, substantive crime occurred. So the argument, I think, is proper, but it's only argument. It's not evidence anyway. Robles says you look at the evidence. You don't look at the argument.
Oh, but I'm asking you about what the people argued during the trial, during the closing argument. Did they separate the two offenses and say this evidence supports the distribution offense and this other evidence supports the conspiracy offense?
No, he didn't. He argued one continuous chain of events, and he didn't argue one to the other, because I think he was looking towards two convictions and not an inconsistent verdict. So he just argued that there was a set of facts that supported both crimes.
Well, I'm puzzled then by what happened, because I'm not sure how the jurors would ascertain what evidence would have supported the conspiracy count and what evidence would have supported the distribution count if the people were just arguing one continuous series of actions.
Well, I think they had the instructions, and the instructions gave them the elements of both crimes, and they followed those instructions, and I think from the instructions they could tell which evidence supported which. And as long as there's a separate fund, we don't vacate the conviction of conspiracy, because if this were an act of leniency, then it just means that the defendant basically gets a twofer. He gets an acquittal on a crime that he committed when in fact he really committed both crimes. But we don't have to look at what the jury actually did, because we're post-Fry. Anyway, for these reasons, the people respectfully request that this court uphold the jury's verdict.
Also, I have some questions about the other issue, even though Mr. Hardy didn't bring them up.
Okay, I'm happy to answer them.
Since you have 7 minutes left.
Okay.
During the voir dire in this case, the trial court, and I'll just rehash a little bit, since we do have guests in the audience, the trial court said, among other things, let me tell you something, folks, defendant did something. And I'll tell you that much right now. He did something, all right? We didn't just go out on the street in front of the courthouse this morning and say, hello, Mr. Cruz Avila. It's your lucky day, okay? Of course he did something, all right? The second issue, as you know, concerns whether or not we should be reversing on the voir dire. And in particular, what I want to ask you about is whether there wasn't, in fact, a biased perception, as opposed to actual biased perception, by telling the jury that we being presumably the court and the prosecution, we didn't just go off the street and pull him in here for this. In conjunction with repeatedly saying, well, of course he did something, of course he did something. Now, could you address that, please?
Sure. I think the judge's use of the word we, he was trying to talk about the concept of probable cause, but in terms that the jury would understand and in terms that were not inflammatory. So when he used the word we, I don't think he was referring to himself and the prosecution. He was referring to, and I think rather clearly, the judicial system. We, the assembled attorneys in the courtroom, and we as the judicial system do not just go out and take people off the corner here, right outside the courtroom. We just don't, you know, take people off the street and bring them in and try them, which is basically illustrates one way or the other the concept of probable cause. And I think most jurors are aware of that. They're aware that in their everyday life, they don't expect to be accused of a crime. But all of this, I'm sorry.
Ms. Pratt, but I mean, certainly you would agree that in some cases, police arrest the wrong person for an offense.
I do, and I think the judge began the voir dire. The very first thing out of the judge's mouth was the hypothetical about how he pointed to a juror, and he said, you juror number three, you stopped for gas on the way home, you inserted your credit card, but the machine was broken, you didn't get a receipt, and you drove off without it. However, simultaneous to what you did, which is innocuous, someone else drove away without paying for gas. And the attendant in the gas station took down the wrong person's name, took down your name instead of the other person's name, and here you stand accused of something you didn't do. And then he went on and he said, so he did something. You know, he asked a question that usually attorneys and trial courts ask juries all the time. When you walked into this room, and you saw the defendant, didn't you wonder what he did? And then he uses this hypothetical of an innocent explanation, and he says, he did something to get here, probable cause. He's presumed innocent of the charge until the prosecution proves every element of the crime against the defendant or against this juror beyond a reasonable doubt. And then he talked about how you would not be able to prove that last element, which is the element that he took gas without paying for it, because of course he did, or she did. So I think it was an innocent explanation, and that predicated all of the discussion about the defendant doing something. And therefore, I think in context, the critical word, context, I think the judge's remarks were clear about what he meant. Okay, I'll try again. If there are no further questions, the people would respectfully request that the defendant's conviction for conspiracy be affirmed. Thank you.
I want to touch on the, I'm not sure how you pronounce this case, it's Scarce or Scarce, or, but it's the 2003 case from this court. It's my position that affirming the conspiracy conviction here would be contrary to that case. And I would note, contrary to what the Attorney General said, that Scarce or Scarce, however you pronounce it, is post-Fry. Fry was 1995. So I'd urge the court to look at that case in making its decision. Now, the Attorney General's argument is essentially that the complicity instruction here doesn't matter. But what all the cases say, all the prior cases say, pre and post Fry, is that we're talking about whether it's an identical, whether it's a separate and distinct funded evidence. Hoffman, which I talked about previously from 1982 from the Supreme Court, takes evidence over a series of months and says this is the identical fund of evidence. In other words, it matters how the case was argued. It matters how the case was presented. And this case was argued and presented on a complicity theory of liability. And
I ask you about this complicity theory. Before you advance questions, guys. Basically, when you're talking about when the offense was committed, it was when the drugs were exchanged for money, correct? And that was when the offense was committed.
If the offense is considered to be the principal doing the offense, yes, I would agree.
Okay. Now, when you say here, there's evidence that the driver could have participated as a principal, and then there's other, it doesn't really matter, though, because assuming that someone committed the offense, even if it were Mr. Macias, as long as the driver aided and abetted under a complicitor theory, then he's liable for the commission of the offense, correct?
The complicity instruction reads that had if the jury found that he had aided and abetted, that's one of the elements of complicity, yes.
So really, it's just a principle of liability and not evidence of the commission of the offense. Would you agree with that or disagree?
No, I disagree.
Okay.
This case was argued under complicity theory, and what the complicity instruction reads in this case is a person is guilty of an offense committed by another person if he is a complicitor. And then lays out the elements of complicity, is guilty. The jury can't just decide whether or not we think he's complicit or not. If they find these elements, he's guilty as a complicit.
Of an offense committed by another person.
Yes.
Okay. And so when I'm looking at the statute, 18.2.206, it's talking about the sole evidence of conspiracy is the evidence establishing the commission of the offense. And so you would read commission of the offense in that statute to include liability for the commission of the offense, correct?
I would read it consistent with Scarce and which is a post-Fry case and consistent with Almeida, which is a pre-Fry, 1969 Colorado Supreme Court case, as complicity changes what you consider the fund of evidence. In other words, what evidence constitutes the commission of the offense under the statute. Again, I urge the court, in response to some of the questioning, to look at the closing argument and determine for yourself whether, how you think these were argued. But I submit this was argued identically for the complicity, substantive offense, and the conspiracy. And Judge Todman, I can't distinguish, much like in response to your question to the Attorney General, I can't distinguish separate funds of evidence here based on that argument. I'd like to touch briefly on the second issue, and I see my time is running out. All I'll say about that is when we go out and take someone off the street, we're the judicial system. We is never the judicial system. It's the prosecution. And that is what aligns the prosecution with the court in that instance, using that terminology. So my time is run out. I just ask the court to vacate the conspiracy conviction. Thank you.
I'd like to thank both counsel for your...